I will call the meeting to order. We have a quorum. And I'd like to move the minutes from the January 24th here.
So moved.
Any discussion of the January 24th minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The minutes are approved. We're going to start with the testimony. I would like to remind people that if you have comments or questions, I would like to get the speakers to get mainly through their thing first, and also to remind you that questions and comments should be about what the presenter is presenting, not about something that's not even on the agenda today. So, Commissioner Light's here. Yep, there he is. Welcome back to the committee, Commissioner Light.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. This is Scott Light, Healthcare Administration Assistant Commissioner from Department of Human Services. Mr. Chair, I'm going to continue with the...
Could I just interrupt? We're having more of the handouts. We handed them on last week. They're going to be using the same ones, but most people are like me and forgot to bring them. Or you can keep them in your folder, would be the thing. But the pages are making more copies right now. How many need a copy? Oh, just a couple. I'm impressed and embarrassed.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. McDonald.
Don't be embarrassed. I forgot mine as well, and hopefully it's right around the corner.
Okay, Commissioner Lights.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to again be referring to the yellow pages that tie to the governor's change item sheets. I left off with page 8 of the yellow document, the one entitled MA Provider Rate Increases for Targeted Service Categories. Mr. Chair, this item is a number of rate increases for our providers who serve clients in our medical assistance program. We haven't done rate increases for a number of years in many of these areas. And one of the things that we recognize is that as more people become eligible for medical assistance or MinnesotaCare, the rates that we pay to providers to serve them need to keep up to ensure that we have access for our clients. And so what this proposal does is to make some investments in rate increases, primarily on our fee-for-service side. And those rate increases are as follows. We do a 2%, the proposal is for a 2%, and by the way, these are effective January 1st of 2014. A 2% fee-for-service increase for our inpatient hospital services, a 3% increase for medical transportation and basic care in fee-for-service. Basic care would be things like medical equipment, lab services, dialysis, public health nursing, and other things. A 5% increase in the fee-for-service outpatient hospital rates, a 5% physician increase both on the primary care and non-primary care side, and then an increase in our fee-for-service dental and managed care dental programs of 5%. Those total around $27 million for the biennium, those investments. And again, this is a really we goal here is to bring up the rates. We rank about 47th in what we pay on the fee for service side for physicians in the country. So we're among the lowest paid in the country, and our dental rates haven't been increased for 14 years on the fee for service side. So we really felt that this was an important area to help to begin to make some dents in reductions that occurred in the past. The next item is on page 9 of the yellow sheet. This is the PMAP, Medical Education and Research Cost Investment, or the MERC Fund. the MERC program, and this ties to page 7 of the governor's change item document, the top item. The MERC program is a program established back a number of years ago to offset some of the costs for clinical training of medical professionals. The goal here was to, when clinical training sites accept trainees, those trainees tend to be less efficient as they're being trained, and so the clinical training sites end up it ends up costing them money to have these folks at the clinical site. The MERC fund helps to offset that cost and ensure that we have training slots for our people coming out of our various medical programs to be able to have a place to where they're trained. We've reduced the MERC fund over the years, and what the governor's budget proposal does is to propose to bring MERC funding back up to the level that it was at coming into fiscal year 11. And so we're really trying to make that investment to kind of restore the MERC fund to where it was at. There's also a recognition that as health reform moves forward, we will need more primary care physicians. We will need more folks who will be able to care for people as they come into the healthcare system. And MERC helps to ensure that that pipeline of training exists. We will be proposing as part of this a change to the formula for distribution of MERC funds. Right now, that the dollars for MERC flow solely on Medicaid volume. So if a training site does a lot of Medicaid volume, it gets more money than one that doesn't do as much Medicaid volume. We still think it's important that the dollars follow Medicaid patients, but we also want to build in some areas of the formula that help to incent training in areas that we know that there are shortages, primary care, mental health, and other areas. So the formula changes will be forthcoming as part of the language. We're working through that right now and working collaboratively with the training institutions on language that we think will work well. But the primary goal here is to restore that funding and make sure that we have a sound base of funding moving forward.
For the members, there'll be a separate hearing, one of our meetings just on MERC for an hour and a half. And particular interest to me. And yeah. Representative Abler, you have a question.
Well, Mr. Chair, I knew you had a passing interest in this topic, maybe more than passing. So just if I get the math right, so the current funding for MERC would be $12.8 million less than $49 million, so it's like $37 million or something. Is that the you know, I was overseeing that at the time, and the MERC number was such a number that changed almost daily, it seemed like, in the final thing. But is that where we settled at? Was about a 25% reduction?
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, your recollection is correct that where we settled was about a 25% reduction for the biennium. What this does is to restore that reduction.
Right, and the House. Sorry, Mr. Chair. Yeah. And Mr. Chair, you know the House fought to try to preserve as much of this as possible, and I'm glad we could keep 75% of it. And maybe the chair will be carrying the bill for the rearranging of MERC, and you know how fun that's going to be. And actually, MERC funding formulas are full employment for lobbyists. You'll have a lot of visits about that topic, I just want to predict, whoever carries it. But maybe just a comment, what I was trying to do when we were attempting to change the formula, and I'm very much favoring targeting it to critical access sites, but in particular some of the health disparity populations. And I tried without much success at all to push it that way. And primary care is certainly important, but I just want to tell you that in Anoka, we have plenty of primary care. If we want to go in to see somebody, we can actually choose from an array of providers and a fine clinic in the city of Ramsey where we go. But there's some populations, and they seem to understand me pretty well, but there are some groups that when they attempt to go, they find somebody who doesn't understand anything about what they're up to. If I could urge us to thinking that way, I think that the system does respond to this $50 million that's there in a very strong way. They do everything they can do to accumulate the money, and we need to provide training sites for the primary care, and I agree with the chair that this is something really, really important conceptually, but maybe as we go forward we can try to focus it on some of the groups that really don't have a chance to be served even in that area where looks like mine. So, thank you, Mr. Chair. That's maybe an editorial, but I'll help you if you want, and thank you.
I'll always be welcoming your help. Assistant Commissioner Lights.
Mr. Chair, that's the end of the presentation from the yellow sheet. I have three additional items that I just want to bring to the committee's attention. The first is on page 6 of the governor's change pages. It's the middle item, and it's continued EMA coverage for cancer and dialysis. There were changes made during the 2011 legislative session to the Emergency Medical Assistance Program that limited the number of services that we cover under that program. When we made those changes, two of the items that were no longer covered were treatment for cancer and treatment for dialysis, or treatment for kidney failure for dialysis treatments. We used, last legislative session, the legislature used one-time money to buy those services back into the EMA program. The governor's budget proposes to continue those services, providing base funding for those two items that were bought back on a one-time basis last year.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
Thanks. I'm supposed to be somewhere else now, too, but I just this topic was also discussed a lot last time. And there's a fair amount of money in this whole EMA program, and it's very contentious. But there are significant gaps that remain here. And with the kind of money we're spending, I still hope there's a way we can find a way to target some preventative service and primary care to the population served by this and not just solve these end problems. And if you were here last year at all, you know that this was a topic that we tried to work on to the very end. And it's a sensitive topic, but an important one. And just if any, and I'm just the ranking minority now, but I hope that there's some way we can find a way to deal with this matter in a way that is going to do better than just deal with these big, massive band-aids on the two conditions that we've continuing the money for. And I appreciate the governor continuing that funding as part of the end of session deal we made. But we just have to do better with this population. So I'm open to help, and if I can stimulate that dialogue, I'm eager to work on that one too, Mr. Chair. So thank you.
Mr. Chair, the next item is actually on page 27 of the governor's changes. It's the very last item that's listed. And this item really relates to a health department, a Department of Health budget item that you'll be seeing if they haven't been before you. This be an item in there. In their governor's change pages. This relates to the newborn screening program. It's a health department administered program that screens infants for congenital conditions. The way that the program is paid for is through fees on the on insurers and the institutions that get passed on. Medicaid, since it's a payer for kids who are screened under the who are Medicaid eligible kids, those costs are passed on to Medicaid. So this is really the change item that results from the health department's change item. We have a budget increase because of the costs that we will incur in the Medicaid program through that item.
So Commissioner Lice, most of this will be through the health department, most of this particular issue.
But Mr. Chair, that's correct. They administer the program.
So.
Yes.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Lights, the question that raises for me is, you know, these, as I understand it, what they're asking to do should identify, well, it says right here, I think, that it will, some disorders will be identified early enough in life to improve medical outcomes. And so I'm wondering if we're able to book any savings, or maybe it isn't able to show up in the budget page, but one would hope that what we'd be doing here is, you know, bending the curve we always talk about. Are we just not able to reflect that, or am I missing it, or is it too long term?
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I think you are correct that over time there are both health improvements and cost savings that occur. It doesn't fall within a budget period in any way that Mr. Hoffman is able to actually put in numbers to it, but we obviously strongly believe that it does have that effect longer term.
Thank you.
Commissioner, well, I'll save that for the Department of Health.
And then the last item, Mr. Chair, that I have is on page 26. It's the bottom item. And this is really just, there's a $96 million transfer that occurs every biennium between the Healthcare Access Fund and the General Fund. I will admit to not having a great deal of depth of knowledge on this. MMB would be, if you want to get into the details, is probably the group that you'll need to talk to. But essentially, we are moving some money from fiscal year 2014 into fiscal year 2015 to ensure that we are able to cover that transfer, which is a statutory transfer that occurs. There's a fair amount of spending in the governor's budget in fiscal year 2014. We make up for that spending in fiscal year 2015 to be able to complete that transfer. And I believe you've exhausted the vast knowledge I have of that item with those words. So again, if there's info that the committee would like on that item in more detail, I'm sure MMB would be able to provide that.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was just pertaining to the newborn screening program. Do you have information or could point us information on what new tests are being added or how many are being added to that program?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mack, I think that will be all be part of the Health Department's budget presentation.
Okay. Anything else, Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, I believe that's all of my items from the Health Care Administration.
Questions for Commissioner Lights? I don't see any, so we'll go on to Mr. Coleman. Thank you, Commissioner Lights.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Coleman, I understand you had the flu.
I spent a couple days in bed taking care of myself, but it was, for me, I was fortunate, Mr. Chair. It was a quick one. Others I've known have labored for quite some time with the flu this season, but I was fortunate. So I appreciate the flexibility to defer my presentation to this week. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lauren Coleman. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Continuing Care at the Department of Human Services. We're the part of the department that is responsible for the administration of the long-term care programs and services for people with disabilities and older Minnesotans. Programs administered by Continuing Care serve individuals with disabilities and older Minnesotans with a variety of needs. Developmental disabilities, chronic medical conditions, acquired or traumatic brain injuries, physical disabilities, people with HIV/AIDS are some of those groups. The continuing care portion of the governor's budget is based on some important themes: empowering consumer participation, continuous improvement and simplification, promoting quality, and building partnerships to manage the numerous change efforts that are underway. Many of these proposals represent the next generation of thinking in Minnesota's system of long-term services and supports. They will help consumers continue to have choice in where they live and work. They'll promote and incent and reward quality in the services that are delivered and ensure that we are good stewards of the state's money as the demographics of the state change. The most comprehensive reform in DHS's budget is the Reform 2020 initiative. This budget takes Minnesota's nation-leading long-term care system to the next level of thinking in making it more consumer-driven, assisting people in need earlier, and emphasizing continuous quality enhancements. This reform also helps guarantee the sustainability of our programs over the long haul by making changes that anticipate the challenges of the coming age wave. Reform 2020 is a bipartisan initiative to reform medical assistance to better meet the challenges of the rising health care costs and the growing aging population, while still providing Minnesotans the services they need to lead fulfilling lives. Several initiatives are in process to build the foundation for these reforms. These include the Universal Assessment for Long-Term Services and Supports, MinChoices, new rate-setting methodologies, which you will learn about later in the session, and updating provided standards for home and community-based services. The first set of change items, Reform 2020, is a package of tools for this continued transformation. We've made over 70 presentations on Reform 2020 since the fall of 2011. Public hearings, webinars, community meetings, local presentations, and federal presentations have taken place. Speaking for all staff of the Continuing Care Administration, we're available to meet with any committee member or community meetings to further discuss Reform 2020. I'll move to the governor's proposals. I'm going to work off of the budget document, and my portion begins on page 9, and I will try to remember to reference the FAST fact sheet that corresponds to the initiative that I'm talking about. So the first FAST fact sheet is number 12, which gives you some additional detail on the proposal. This proposal simplifies and makes the common entry point more accessible to receive reports of abuse, neglect, exploitation of vulnerable adults through a single statewide toll-free number and a web-based reporting center. Currently, there are 87-plus ways to report situations where people feel adults may be vulnerable. This would centralize that. It does not change the investigation or the follow-up to those reports. There are some reports that the Department of Health are responsible for, some reports counties are responsible, and some reports DHS is responsible for. But this takes that mystery out of the equation for somebody to report. It also then helps us collect a complete database of all of the reports of vulnerable adults throughout Minnesota that are coming into those three parts of the system. It recognizes that we have a dispersed long-term care system now. Most people are living in their own homes, living outside of institutions, and we're going to need to depend upon family, friends, neighbors to watch for situations where people may be vulnerable and help us investigate those situations where they may be at risk. Additionally, it recognizes that the counties need some resources with which to conduct their investigations, and so there is money in here for the counties to do so. And we think that this will improve and position us for the future as we have most people living in the community rather than institutions. Questions on this particular proposal?
Representative Loeffler, but before that, what's the definition of adult in this one? What's the age?
I believe it's 18 or older, but I would need to reference either 18 or 21,
I mean, Mr. Chair. There was a horrible thing in the paper about a month ago about, I think it was a 19-year-old woman that was being basically taken out for abuse by her foster care person. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Assistant Commissioner Coleman. I just wonder if, before we go to this, if, you know, there needs to be some field testing, I mean, even just in terms of capacity, but having dealt with, like, constituents who've called me with concerns about a neighbor and others, I mean, it takes a lot of courage for a lot of people to feel like they can rat out, as they might think of it, a neighbor who they're really worried about. And, calling an 800 number feels a lot more distant. I think that's why they call me, as opposed to calling someone else. And, you know, and then I refer them to the county. I'm just wondering if it just has even... if that might have a chilling effect on people's comfort level that it goes to a statewide number as opposed to a local service agency that they might know someone who works in that area, or they might. And so the last thing we want to do is chill people's comfort with sharing concerns about a friend, a neighbor, a relative, and feeling comfortable about how it might be handled in the end. And what's the efficiency that you project of the handoff? Because as I understand what you're saying is that the local governments will still be responsible for much of the follow-up. So you call into an 800 number, somebody asks you a series of questions, and that you get handed off to someone else. I mean, you know, will this be 24/7? How does the handoff work? Just kind of give us a little bit more of a walkthrough of how you see it working.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, certainly the intent is exactly the opposite of what you're suggesting, that it would have a chilling effect. These would be trained call center people who would know how to accept the call. Part of what's needed also is a public awareness campaign so that people are aware of how to report. It doesn't prevent people from calling a local official or a local county or some other agency. It doesn't prevent that. They still can exercise that choice. But we believe that the efficiency would come with a single toll-free number, a call center. Secondly, it would provide a more prompt response, where the agency, the entity that is responsible for conducting the investigation, can get right on that because it is coming through a triage, so to speak, making sure that the call is going to the appropriate government entity for follow-up, rather than risking that people don't know who to call or that it gets lost in the system because, you know, is it a DHS, is it a county responsibility? So it alleviates that vagueness up front, with the experts knowing who exactly needs to follow up and so forth. It also uses a tool that actually the counties have been working on, a standardized tool to make sure that we're getting the same information, the same protocols for follow-up with a potential vulnerable adult at risk. So we do believe that it would be an improvement, but it would take some education, it would take some learning, but the intent is to take the mystery out of who do I call, and again, not create further distance, but it's another option for people that we think people would avail themselves of.
Just to follow up, Mr. Coleman, and will it be 24/7, and, you know, is it, what's the standard handoff if it has to go to another agency for response, that sort of thing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, I don't know that it would be 24/7. We would have to test that to see whether, in fact, there are enough volume. I mean, we've had some experience with other call centers to flex hours to assure that Minnesotans have a place to call. If it's likely that it's of that kind of immediate need, there is still 911 opportunities, but we would start with a 24/7 and then see whether the volume of calls justifies that.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, and thank you, Mr. Chair, because I think we do currently now require that every county have a 24/7 crisis line or something or other, and I mean, I think there'd be data out there about utilization and things like that, but I do think if we're going to really promote it, then it really needs to be accessible.
Representative Norton.
Mr. Chair, I'm mindful of the time here, and we can probably, all of us are interested in all these subjects. I'm worried we're not going to get through the presentation, so I'm wondering, would it be best for us to hold questions till he gets through his entire presentation, or do you really want them one at a time? Because I feel like we're still on page one, and I do have questions that I might want to ask, but I want to get through the rest of the information too. So I'm wondering, would you prefer us to maybe hold these, or?
Well, I would prefer that you hold them till he finishes up, however, if you got just a precise small question, go ahead and ask those.
Well, I'll defer mine till the end then, and in because I would like to hear the rest of the presentation.
Very good. Mr. Chair, members of the committee,
I'll just one more.
I'll wait till the end. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll continue on the next item, which is the alternative care and essential community supports. This one is a budget proposal that that is anticipating federal match on the Alternative Care and Essential Community Supports Program. It was part of our waiver application to the federal government, to CMS, where we have advanced the case that the Alternative Care Program and Essential Community Supports is saving the state money. In turn, it is saving the federal government money, and the federal government ought to participate. This program, the Alternative Care Program, is a long-standing state-funded program to help people stay in their homes. These are people who are not yet impoverished to the point where they need to apply for medical assistance. So by providing some modest support to them, it keeps them off of medical assistance and in their home where they prefer to be. We do not have a response from CMS yet on this. It is part of the waiver package that we are in discussions with the federal government currently. A portion of this federal match is already dedicated from a previous session to buy back a reduction that occurred a couple years ago. The numbers reflected are the remaining dollars if we were to achieve a federal support for this program.
Go ahead, Mr.
The next item, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is improving access to home community-based services for older people who are ventilator-dependent. The current system requires an individual who is ventilator-dependent to go into a nursing facility for 30 days in order to be discharged with a rate sufficient to pay for their elderly waiver services. Otherwise, the rates that we pay under elderly waiver would not accommodate the needs of an individual who's ventilator dependent. We're eliminating that step. We're saying that really is an outdated process. We don't need to do that. We should just provide the funding appropriate for individuals who are ventilator dependent who wish to live in the community. And so this creates that exception for these individuals. It doesn't have a budget impact because we would pay for those services either in the nursing facility or in the community. Moving to the next proposal, which would be the first contact simplification access and transitions. This is a significant reform, and this does create a number of strategies of that are intended to, again, help us prepare better for the aid wave. The details, Fast Facts, is number 13, if you want to follow along on that also. This really is changing the way we first interact with individuals who need services and support. It changes the pre-admission screening process. Currently, that's a county function where primarily it's a telephone call with an individual who is thought to be needing nursing facility care. And it's proposed that we shift that responsibility to the linkage lines where consumers are increasingly going to access good information with which to make decisions. So again, we're regionalizing it because the linkage lines are regionally based. They're familiar with what the services are in their parts of the state. And it frees up the counties to do the more face-to-face long-term care consultation work for individuals with more complex needs. It does not change the what's referred to as the second level of screening for people with developmental disabilities or mental illness. That still would be a function of the counties. But pre-admission screening is quite large now, and we think that the linkage lines can do that better. It also expands the Return to Community program. The Return to Community program is something that the legislature approved several years ago, which is a targeted program to help people who are living in a nursing facility who wish to return home. Many people who go into a nursing home today for an episodic care are returning home with the help of their families, friends, etc. But there are some individuals who need a little more planning, a little more support in order to achieve that goal. These are private paying individuals, which again is intended to help people return home, conserve their assets as long as possible, and so that they can not need to impoverish themselves and go on medical assistance. The Return to Community Program has helped over 600 individuals, and I'm probably dating the number there a little bit. That's the last number I received. It is administered through our area agencies on aging, which again are regional based. They know the services available in the community, and so they employ community living specialists to work with the individual and their families to return them home.
Right now, is this a completely state-funded, since they're not eligible for anything?
Mr. Chair, the pre-admission screening and the return to community is funded by the state, and there's some participation by the federal government. But again, it's a strategy to try to intervene earlier with individuals to help them remain off of the public program. A nuance on this is the screening is currently funded through the nursing home rates. There's a portion of what we pay to the nursing facilities that they then in turn have to submit to the county in order for the county to do the work. We would eliminate that portion of the nursing facility rate, and we would administer it through an administrative function, which is via a time study methodology.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just to thank you for your testimony, Commissioner Coleman. We all know there's this fiscal cliff coming up again March 1st. And, you know, on these programs that we're talking about, if the Congress can't agree and the President, and we go into this, I think it's sequestration is the term, if I hit that right. How does that affect these programs, and to what degree do you have any backup plans?
Mr. Chair, Representative, our programs are not the prime focus, as I understand it, of the sequestration process, although there's no guarantees. And Congress and the President could decide anything. And I can't say that we have a backup plan for something that's unknown. We will need to assess those decisions at the federal level at that time. But certainly all of the programs are at some level of risk. I think some of our federal Older Americans Act programs are of particular concern to us, that help support people in a very informal way with our network of providers. That's of greater concern to us than some of these issues with Medicaid.
Thank you, Mr.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, another feature of this proposal is to develop a home and community-based report card. You'll hear more about that later on, but we've had what we believe great success, and we've received significant encouragement from other states about the development of our nursing facility report card that occurred several years ago. Now, that doesn't mean that the home and community-based report card needs to be identical to the nursing facility report card, but the same concept of helping individuals who are choosing services have good information about providers, about the system, measuring quality, incenting quality. We believe that the nursing facility report card because of the public nature of it, has really challenged that particular provider sector to improve their services, because people are measuring, people are monitoring, people are comparing. And we believe that many nursing facilities have actually met that challenge. We've seen a gradual increase in the quality scores over the years from facilities with the introduction of the report card. So it's a key part of this to provide good information and incent quality for the home community-based sector. A little more complicated than nursing facilities, but we have to develop those measurements, and we have a start on that with working through stakeholder groups and identifying what is of most interest to consumers of all ages, people with disabilities as well as older Minnesotans who want to make a good consumer choice.
I could just interrupt here. Speaking of report cards, we have a group that came in to be very interested in report cards. And that's the 11th and 12th grade students from Lions Lake Academy that are here with the Historical Society looking at the Capitol and seeing what we do here and how the public has input. So thanks for your attendance, and why don't we give them a little applause. Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, moving on, the next item that I'll reference is home and community-based critical access study and service development. And there is a, there's only a reference to that on the Reform 2020, a short description that would be handout number 10. What we're trying to do here is acknowledge that we really need to study whether there is access to the appropriate long-term care services and supports throughout the state. So it's a one-time access study. Now, we do other kinds of evaluations. We have gaps analysis, which was due later on this year, which is now a combined analysis for both older Minnesotans as well as people with disabilities that the counties respond to, identifying what services do they need more of in their local communities. The access, though, is are individuals able to get to the services that are available, and what are the barriers that may exist to that so that we can better plan the design and the distribution of our long-term services and supports. It also builds upon the Community Service Development Program, which again has been a tool available to Minnesota for a number of years now as part of the long-term care reform work of a dozen years or so ago now, to build the home community-based infrastructure, to simply say we want people to get supports in their home or in their community doesn't make it happen. So this has been able to provide some seed money to providers, matching funds to help them build the services that are needed in their communities. Part of this fund has been suspended for a few years now. We're trying to manage the fund more smartly, targeting those services that gaps analyses and consumer preferences are requesting. It's via a RFP process where we publish a request for proposals for providers to apply for these funds, and then we distribute the funds based upon need and merit. So this has been a critical tool to build the infrastructure across Minnesota to help people remain in the community.
Just for the students that came in, this is the Health and Human Services Finance Committee, and we're in charge of about a third of the state budget. And Mr. Coleman is the Assistant Commissioner in charge of what we call long-term care, and that's for people that you would think of as nursing homes, but there's other facilities to provide those for seniors that are in need of this kind of care. And also in this, in his budget, is the group that have disabilities. Not all of those are obviously seniors. Some can be disabled from birth on. And it's a relatively small part of our population, but it's probably 25% of the state's budget goes to take care of these people. And so it's very important that they certainly need the care, and we have to make sure they get good care. On the other hand, we try to make it as efficient as possible, because it's so expensive for a relatively small part of our society.
And there won't be a test.
No. You all get an A from me. All right, Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll move on to Individual Community Living Support, ICLS, as we refer to it. And this is a new service that we are proposing to add to the Elderly Waiver and the Alternative Care Program. Many of you know how complex our system is, and although we talk about simplification every year, it's still, when you are faced with the prospect of a family member or as an individual needing to seek out services to help you remain in your home, it's an overwhelming task for the individual as well as the family. Many people get exhausted trying to patch together an array of services, be it home care, chore services, meals, nurse care, etc. And they get exhausted, and they resort to moving to what has been developed in Minnesota as a response to consumer preference, customized living, assisted living. And we see that being built on in many communities, and it's a valuable service. What this is saying, though, is that we can do a better job at bundling those services through a single provider that will then bring that bundled service into an individual's home so that they don't need to move to another housing location with which to have the services tailored to their needs. We believe that there are providers who are willing to do this, that they can assess the individual, tailor a package that meets their needs, and then be held accountable for whether the individuals and the services are being delivered on a daily or weekly basis, depending on the needs of the individuals. We think that there are more people who would remain in their homes longer and delay a move to another setting if this was a service available to them. It's the same kind of services that are available now. It just puts it in a package, so you can purchase it all at one, tailored to your needs. Okay. Moving on, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, crisis diversion and discharge planning to reduce avoidable costs. We know we have a number of individuals with disabilities, many with mental illness, who are accessing emergency room services and hospitalizations frequently. This proposal is a strategy to deploy a limited number of clinical experts who can work with the individual, the hospital, the support to break those cycles that are causing people to use multiple emergency room visits or hospitalizations. Many of these individuals don't currently have crisis plans or others that are supporting them. So this is a strategy to provide that technical assistance. There are literally thousands of individuals who are experiencing multiple hospitalizations, and a better coordination of that with technical assistance will produce better results for those individuals. We believe this will save money. Unique to this proposal, it does not save money in my budget. It saves money in Commissioner Leitz's budget, the health care budget. Nevertheless, we think we have some expertise to work with individuals who are experiencing these repeat hospitalizations or emergency room visits, but this saves health care dollars rather than long-term care dollars.
Commissioner, so this is the buzzwords are frequent flyers?
Mr. Chair, that could be a description, but multiple users of more of inappropriate services that we could do a better job with.
Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Mr. Chairman and members, that was a bill that we passed last year, the outreach bill that was brought to me by the Owatonna Hospital social workers, and that's a pilot project down there. And in my community at Owatonna, they're saving hundreds of thousands of dollars on those folks. It's been very effective, so we hope we can improve upon that and use it throughout the entire state in the future.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And since we're stopped or paused here, I just want to ask Mr. Coleman, the savings, is this only for people who get their care fee-for-service, or is this also apply to the bulk of people who are on PMAP? Or maybe that's for Mr. Leitz.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I can't answer that definitively. I would suspect that we would anticipate savings from both programs wherever we're achieving the efficiencies.
Mr. Chair. Okay.
Mr. Coleman.
Okay.
Representative Aber.
I have questions on all these, and I'm not asking any, but I just have a comprehensive question on all these. I'm trying to read the spreadsheet here and look at the little limited information we have, and I can't tell what federal money is and what state money is. Is there a code I'm missing on this? It seems like last year's spreadsheets were more clear. We have federal money coming, and everything is general fund, and I don't know the back numbers to know if those are a code for federal or not, but it can't be answered now, but as we go forward, we have to know what federal and state is, and is that something way different that I know we were talking about the new system, but you know anything about that?
Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I believe the tracking sheet reflects the state budget. Where we are getting federal participation administratively, I think it's indicated with FFP on the tracking sheet, and that's about as much detail as I'm aware of as how these sheets are constructed.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair, maybe I'll just take it offline. Maybe Mr. Berg can help me later. But the administrative FFP is listed, but it still reflects general fund. And I know there's federal money throughout all these things, and it's in the base amounts and grants, and there's a negative number that's very large, which has to be federal money. So just as we go further into our process, if the department could help us by giving us a yellow highlighted version so we know what, if they can't do it through the computer version, I'm willing to color mine. But I think it's going to be, you're going to discover this to be an interesting thing as we go forward. So is that, am I right about this? Is it different?
Mr. Bowman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I just have to plead that I don't have that level of detail to how the sheets are constructed.
Yeah, I'll take it offline.
Mr. Berg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, very briefly, what Assistant Commissioner Coleman said is right. If you look at this initiative, there's a last line called Administrative FFP. As a contrast, if you look at the next item down on the spreadsheet, I'm looking at the last, is Administrative FFP, or one says FFP at 35%. That's the federal matching dollars that are going to be brought in as part of this particular initiative, and they're listed, you see General Fund Revenue 1. The way they're booked in the spreadsheet is an offset to General Fund costs. If you want to look on a larger level, the fund balance looks at the total amount of administrative FFP brought in, and that number jumps from about $49 million in the current biennium under the governor's proposal. It jumps up to about $58 or $59 million on a biennial basis. But you'll only see the part that's relative to each of these initiatives on the spreadsheet under that initiative.
Mr. Chair, not to delay it, but I just want to make my question clear so somebody can help me. Like, if you go back to page one of the spreadsheet, the whole ACA expansion, that's all federal money coming in. And it doesn't say, and the FFP is probably on page two or something, but it doesn't give me a hint that that's federal source or that it's a saving. So I'm trying to decide which of these save money and which just draw on more federal money, and looking at the spreadsheets and even the explanations, I can't tell the difference. So never mind, I'll work on it.
If I can just to help students here, medical assistance is a federal program. Yeah, that was started in Washington, I believe, 1965, and it's to help very low-income people or people with disabilities. And in the state of Minnesota, the feds in general pay 50%, and the state taxpayers pay the other 50% of the cost of these programs. So it's a 50-50 mix in this state between federal program, federal money, and state money. We tend to pay much more attention to the state money. So it's somebody else. Yeah. Okay. Commissioner, move ahead.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll move on to Community First Services and Supports. And that is referenced on your handout number 15. This is a significant piece of the Reform 2020 initiative. It represents the next generation of thinking of supports for people with disabilities and older Minnesotans, which would replace our current PCA program. It doesn't duplicate it, it replaces it. So it takes a number of the features of our current program, but it improves them. The CFSS program, which is allowable under the new federal laws, is a more flexible program. Our current PCA program, by and large, requires individuals to be dependent on services, that they can't do things for themselves. And we can't pay for things such as training and skills development, etc. The new program that is being proposed would allow us to teach people to do things for themselves and make them more independent than the current PCA program is allows us to do. There is also a subset in here which is really designed to test innovative models of service coordination for children who are receiving Community First Service Supports or PCA services. And the challenge is to coordinate the services across the home, the school, and the community. Now, we are not declaring what that innovative approach needs to look like. It would be done through an RFP process where we would ask communities to propose to us, what kind of approach would you like to test using CFSS in coordination with schools and community supports to improve the outcomes for children in your communities. There's criteria for who the children would be. It's limited in scope, so we can test those innovations and then select those that are producing the best outcomes to export to other communities. They would have to have complex health needs. So there is criteria by which the RFP would be constructed, but it's kind of a subset for us to really look at how we can coordinate better for this subset of children. The design of the Community First Service and Supports is required by the federal government to be to use an implementation council comprised of at least 51% of actual users of the service. We have begun that process. We have been meeting, we've been developing work groups, trying to structure the program to meet the consumer preferences as to how flexibility would work best. It also allows us, because of the financing mechanism, to increase the lowest number of minutes authorized in a given day from 30 minutes a day to, on average, 75 minutes a day. That was one of the reductions that we proposed and was enacted a couple years ago with the reform of the PCA program. This allows us to increase that lowest level of authorization. It retains some of the current features of our program. For example, the home care rating system, where the assessment is conducted and then that rating translates into an authorized number of hours. Some of those features are retained, so we're not trying to start from scratch. We're trying to take what we are already doing well and build upon that. There is significant, and I'll let them speak for themselves, but we've had significant stakeholder support for proposing this new program as part of Reform 2020. Those are some of the highlights.
Thank you. And just very quickly, a lot of what you're describing, and I think this is very innovative and we need to do more of this, I'm wondering if we aren't already doing something and how this ties to the Centers for Independent Living, like I have in my community, who I think does a lot of this already. So I'm wondering, does this expand that? Does it link to it? Would you be using the SEMSLs and other organizations? I'm just wondering what the connection is, if there is one.
Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we value the SILs, and we think they still have a very appropriate and important role. So we would build upon the services that they provide currently. It doesn't replace them or try to do anything negative to them whatsoever.
Thank you.
Okay, the next topic, work, empowerment, and encourage independence. You have a fast fact sheet on that number. Well, it's on page 11. It's part of the Reform 2020. Gives you a bit of a description, not much. What we have learned over the years is that people with disabilities also want to work. They want competitive employment. They want to be as self-sufficient as possible. And the expectations of both the consumers as well as the business community, as well as us as program managers, are changing. And this is intended to further the notion that work is more of an expectation, a goal, and should be part of a life plan. We have experience with this through a federal grant. The demonstration to maintain independence, where we provided navigation support to individuals, particularly with mental illness, who either were seeking employment or were trying to maintain their employment. And with these navigators, they could get good information, good support, intervene earlier if employment was at risk, help people manage that part of their life a bit better. We worked through keeping people healthier. It was a contract with Medica, for example, where they provided these navigators. Keeping people healthier so that they're able to show up for work, keep their job, etc. What we're trying to do here is target particularly 18 to 26-year-olds, that phase of a person's life where they're trying to establish themselves. And if we can help them gain employment and maintain their employment, they're getting off to a much better start. So that's what this is looking to do, is to apply what we've learned through our Pathways to Employment, through our DEMI project, and target that specific population. Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the next item intensive services for children with autism spectrum disorder. As all of you know, this is an emerging body of knowledge. It's an emerging community and family issue that many people are searching for the best answers. We've been working very closely with an advisory council, with the HSAC, or the Health Services Advisory Council, various entities to try to improve services for children of all ages who have a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder. What we can all agree on is early intervention is something that we're all striving for. The earlier we can identify and intervene and coordinate services for children and families of children with autism, the better opportunity they have for improving their life over time. So this proposal is more intensive than what we've done before. It does not replace the benefits that are already available within the Medicaid program. This enhances it. This better coordinates it, so again, with the children who have autism, to better coordinate their services under medical assistance, their school experience, which is a significant part of their life, their family experience, as they're challenged with managing the family entity. It requires a multidisciplinary diagnostic evaluation. It is not a new evaluation. It's bringing all the evaluations, because everybody's looking at this problem, is bringing all of the current assessments together so that they're not working against each other. They're working with a single plan. Again, targeting early intervention therapy, OT, ST, or speech therapy, physical therapy, children's therapeutic services and supports. Again, a more intensive approach to this challenge. So it's not the end of the conversation about autism, but we are continuing to work with our stakeholders to design this benefit set to better meet the needs of children.
By the way, members, this afternoon we're having a hearing on autism in the policy committee, and Representative Norton will have a lot to say about that. Commissioner, there's been a big change apparently in the definitions of these kinds of disorders by the medical community. Is that going to affect what your program is doing?
Mr. Chair, I'm not aware of the assessment of that impact yet. It could be, we'll have to get you some information on that.
Representative Liebling.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, since we're stopped on this one, I just wanted to see, Mr. Coleman, could you just kind of tell us real quickly, if you're a family with a child with autism, what difference would you see from this program that you're talking about? I'm looking at the numbers here, and I'm assuming that this isn't going to actually provide a new treatment that people don't currently get. From your explanation, I'm assuming this is more of, well, maybe I could just ask you, you know, what's the difference? What's the difference going to look like at the family level?
Mr. Chair, Representative, a better coordinated approach, a better upfront assessment earlier would be the intent, so that we can identify the autism spectrum disorder earlier, and then better coordination between services that we are providing under medical assistance with services that that the school is providing, that the family is providing in terms of training and so forth, that we can impact the disorder better, I think, and earlier. it's not necessarily applying a range of new services that aren't currently available, but it's challenging better planning and evaluation along the way. For example, part of this, and we're still working on this, with integrating the benefit set with the HSAC recommendations and the advisory council, but one of the features, for example, would be a monitoring every 6 months, so that we really can look at, well, what has been the impact to the individual, to the child, at that six-month marker, and then adjust if something different needs to be tried, or expand, contract, but adjust the plan if it's warranted. If it's working and needs to be continued, it would continue to be authorized to so forth. So it's putting in some decision processes that are best left to the clinicians to decide what is most appropriate for that individual circumstance. So, better coordination, better access to services. It's intended to kind of demystify some of the ambiguity around what services are children with autism eligible for, what's working, what's not working.
Mr. Coleman, go ahead.
All right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the next item on the list is transition initiatives for certain populations. I defer on that one. That will be presented by Commissioner Berry when she does her presentation. So we're going to skip over that one at this point in time. It is addressing some issues that we have around individuals living at the security hospital and at Anoka Regional Treatment Center. The next topic that I'll address is nursing facility rate increases and quality add-on. And we have a reference sheet on that for you. Number 19. What this proposal does is distributes a rate increase to nursing facilities of approximately 2%. It delivers a rate increase of a little over 1% to all facilities each year of the biennium, and then the additional 1% on average is distributed based upon their quality score. Again, we referenced a report card for nursing facilities earlier. We have a quality score for each nursing facility on the report card and participate in our programs. And this would deliver that quality add-on of a range based upon that calculation. We've done so in the past. It's been a while now since we've had the opportunity to distribute rate increases like this, and we are proposing to do so over the next 4 years with the nursing facilities. The following 2 years is proposed to be based entirely upon the quality score. For this biennial budget, a question that always arises is whether it goes into the base budget or the base rate for the facilities. Yes, it does. They earn the rate increase for these 2 years, and it does become part of their rate permanently. I'll stand for questions.
How does this relate? Your department's doing the quality measures, as opposed to the health department that comes in and looks at more of the health end of a thing when they.
Mr. Chair, the compliance visits that the health department conducts are part of the report card. That is part of the score that each facility earns. But it's not the only part of what the quality is. There are a number of factors in the report card, and the health department evaluation is one of those factors.
Thank you. Representative Norton.
Thank you. And I guess I'm looking at this from a different perspective. I'm the patient in the nursing home, and my nursing home isn't rated quality. And by not getting the extra money, me as the individual is going to have not good care and perhaps worse care as the person in the home. I understand what you're trying to do, and I appreciate it, and I think, you know, incenting people to do better and paying them better is fine, but if I'm the person in that home that doesn't get the quality, I'm going to be hurt even worse because they're going to be paid worse and they're going to be less quality people there and higher turnover and on and on. So I guess how do I reconcile this as the person in the bed in one of those homes that isn't getting the raise?
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, I don't know if I'm going to answer this directly, so come back at me if I've missed your point. Part of the quality score, a large part of the quality score, is consumer feedback. We actually interview thousands of nursing facility residents each year, and they get to tell us what is the quality of the services that they receive. That is the consumer satisfaction survey that we conduct each year. We don't do that as state employees. We contract it out to a third party to make sure that it's credible. So consumers do have significant impact upon the quality score of facilities, what they earn during the course of the year.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Representative.
Thank you. And I appreciate that, and I think that's wonderful. But I'm in one. I've given you my feedback, and my feedback says I'm not in a quality facility, and this particular facility then is rated poorly and the increase does not follow because they're not quality. I'm still stuck in that facility getting poor care that's not going to get any better because they're not getting the more money. Do you see what I'm saying? From the consumer perspective, I'm worried that we're going to hurt the people that are in the bed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, let me take another approach. We have another program. We have lots of programs. It's called the PIP program, the Performance Incentive Performance Program. And that, again, is available to all nursing facilities to apply to us periodically. We have an RFP process to apply to us to propose what area of service would they like to improve. It's specific to the individual facility, and everyone is eligible. And many facilities have applied and participate, and they're able to earn a bonus payment if they achieve the objectives. Again, it's tailored to the individual site. So that is a tool by which facilities can improve their quality score over time. It doesn't happen all at once, but again, we're trying to help all facilities, whether they're in the middle of the pack or the lowest of the scores, to improve. And that's a way for the facilities to get additional resources to improve their scores.
And thank you. I do want to move on, so I'm going to stop asking questions on this. But I do think sometimes, just as in schools, when they did all the No Child Left Behind and all that, initially what they did was they went into the school and they said, you have a problem and we're going to help you fix it. And there was money that went with it, but you had to follow an intervention that somebody helped you fix. And if I'm the patient in that place that doesn't have high quality and I'm not getting any money for my staff, I want to know that somebody at the state is going to fix it. So we can talk about this offline, but it seems like there's a little a tweak somewhere that I'd like to see worked on.
Mr. Coleman, continue. Oh, Representative Liebling.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and just since we're discussing this, I just want to throw something else in that has come up recently in my community, and that is that part of the problem, too, is that consumers can't vote with their feet, and I don't mean to be facetious there, obviously, they're vulnerable people, but I mean there are very few openings
when you go to look for a nursing home opening, sometimes you're lucky if you find one. So you don't have a lot of choice. And so a place might be really low rated, but by golly, it's the only thing available. So that is a problem. People in the situation that Representative Norton's talking about, they can, you know, express their view on a survey, but really it comes down to they're stuck.
Mr. Chair.
Well, again, Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, we have tried a variety of strategies to help facilities apply successfully to the Performance Improvement Program. We have tutored facilities about how to construct an improvement plan. We've mentored. We've had requests for facilities who have higher scores to mentor those facilities with lower scores. So there's a variety of strategies that we're trying to employ to help those facilities who may not have the skills necessary to apply but still have a desire to improve their scores. There are more choices today than before, but yes, there are pockets where choices of where to receive your services are still limited.
Yep. Mr. Chair. Oh, sorry. Okay.
Mr. Coleman, we've got just a few minutes left. How much more do you think you can get done?
I'll go as long as you want me to go. There's not a lot left, but there still are some substantial topics, and I can return tomorrow if you wish.
Okay, Representative Abler.
And I'm trying to bite my tongue, but just can you just tell me in 2014 how big the rate increase is that a 1% additional in 2014? You said it was a 1.1 in 2013, and then in 2014 it's.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ehler, each year is what is projected in the alternative payment system forecast, and it's approximately 2% each year.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question regarding the quality, the add-ons. So the rate increase will take effect in 2013, and so too will the quality add-on rates. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, they each occur on October 1 of each year.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. Well, then, based upon that information, we all recognize that nursing homes have had a rate freeze, and staffs are short-staffed. They're working overtime, so the quality of care is very challenging for them. The pay, of course, is to be questioned as well. There's employment other areas in their communities they can make a lot more and work less. So I think that the program, although sounds good on the surface, I think it could have some unintended consequences. I think you're going to have at least a year's worth of work with the rate increases to help the quality of care get better quality. All of a sudden, you're going to raise the rates, which are important for the nursing home. Then you're going to also turn around and give them a quality add-ons immediately, not give them the opportunity to improve their quality care. Does that make sense? So I think it seems like you're putting the cart before the horse, or the chicken before the egg, metaphorically speaking. Can you respond to that?
Commissioner Coleman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the quality measures are not unknown. They are the same quality measures that we have displayed for a number of years. I will concur that the economic challenges, the business challenges, for not only nursing facilities, but for all of our long-term care services within continuing care are significant. And I would concur that most nursing facilities have not received an increase for several years. But that is also true for the other parts of our home and community-based system also. This is how we are proposing to distribute the rate changes October 1 of each year. We think that it's a good way of trying to recognize that all nursing facilities would get something, but we also want to reward performance.
Okay, we have two more questions, and then we're going to have to adjourn. So Representative Fisher.
Oh, it was me.
Representative Fritz.
Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be brief. I just want to make a comment that, you know, we're 20% behind in the rates in nursing homes in the state of Minnesota, not 2%. And, you know, we will never get 20%. I understand that. But every year I come here with a bill asking for a larger percentage than 2%. And the add-on of the quality care piece, and I'm working on that with other folks on the other side of the aisle, and hoping to bring something forward that when you look at the quality piece, the incentive, that money should go back to the nursing home to provide improvements among the staff in ways that that would benefit the care that Representative Norton would be getting in the nursing home. So that's that's another idea that we we could think about. Thank you.
Well, we're out of time, and so thank you, Commissioner, and we'll see you again tomorrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And with that, the meeting is adjourned.